Hello everybody, this is the Gingerbread Man and I'd like to welcome you to my home. Tonight we're going to discuss something a little bit different. We're going to be looking into some science, more specifically evolutionary biology and genetics. But before that, I'd like to speak about something really weird that I just witnessed. Something that's always really sketched me out is when people wake up, like especially like my own child. Ever since he was very little, he'll wake up in the middle of the night and just be really weird, like real strange. Like when he was like 2.5 years old, he wasn't speaking at all. And he would get up and walk out of his room and like his eyes would be like rolled back in his head, like exorcist style, and wouldn't be talking, wouldn't be giving any sort of reaction at all, you know, and it used to happen quite frequently and not as often now, but you know, when I was going to gather my equipment tonight, I walked upstairs to go get everything out of our room that we're sharing. And, you know, he's just bolt upright in his bed. He looked wide awake, but incoherent and not really speaking clearly. And, you know, and so he's just shaking and like, I'm worried that he might be nauseous or sick. You know, sometimes you walk in the bed and the kid gets up and just like vomits everywhere. You know, and so, yeah, so it's just real weird. And I've always been like a sleepwalker myself, and going back to being very little, you know, I would walk outside the house even, you know, and like sometimes my dad would have to corral me back in. And, you know, I'll sleep talk to people, like people that have lived with me will tell me that I'll have complete conversations with them while I'm completely catatonic and asleep. You know, I'll sleep smoke, you know, like I'll wake up and just be belligerent because everything I have is gone and it would have just been sleeping me, you know, having a jolly old time. I don't sleep eat often, but still, it's just, why do we do things so strange when we're in that in-between space between waking and full consciousness? But anyway, tonight we are going to be looking into a book that I recently just finished. The author in question is Theodosius Dobzhansky. He is a Ukrainian-American. He's Ukrainian-born, and he immigrated to America when he was 27. And so he was born into Russian-controlled, you know, Soviet, I don't know if it was Soviet Union, but probably Soviet Union. I got most of my information off of Wikipedia, to be honest. I was just trying to get like a decent synopsis for who this guy was. But he was born January 24th, 1990. And he died December 18th, 1975. He was part of putting together a new synopsis or a new recounseling of Darwin's basic ideas of evolution. And the facets of this included, you know, Malthusian hypothesis, which Malthus was a English guy, I believe. I just saw his book at a bookstore and I almost picked it up, but it was like 600 pages and it looked grueling. But he basically thought that human population, more children are always going to be born than die when there's a surplus. So there's like modern checks that happen that keep people in line of not overpopulating, and this includes like war and famine, because if you can't produce enough food, like population grows exponentially, which means you could have one person will split to two, which will make four, which will make 16, which will make 32, whereas food supplies generally grow in a linear form, which means it would go one food, two food, three food, four food. And it's really hard to really push it unless your technology is going up, which has happened for a long time. But we still have these issues trying to feed people, and there's still people starving all over the world, which is worrisome if we have the potential to feed more people, which means we might have to think about it. I think there's holes in his theory, that aren't bound by new technological advancements and different ideas that we can implement using our brains, which is what we'll get into more concerning Dobzhansky's idea. And so then another part of modern synthesis would include natural selection, which leads to, you know, like survival of the fittest, which is like natural selection is like this, like almost like this mysterious force that guides things to things that succeed naturally in its environment, or even with an environment that's changing, the things that succeed would be selected more often, you know, in the genetics. And so things that are successful will happen more often, and they'll be selected by this force, and which leads to, you know, the survival of the fittest idea, where the fittest would survive, which led to social Darwinism, which is a major faux pas for a lot of scientifically minded people that are looking at, you know, all these theories concerning how and why we changed, or if we changed. You know, some people even doubt that, but I digress. And it also includes ideas such as variation, which is how things, you can have one population that will split into subspecies, and sometimes they can keep interbreeding, but sometimes things split so far away that you no longer have the ability for a genetic swapping between life forms. And then it also includes, like, you know, of course, I think I just mentioned mutation, like how things can just sporadically happen and how genes can come out of nowhere sometimes. And sometimes how a random change that has occurred can actually fit the environment, and that'll be naturally selected more often. Whereas this blending of all these different ideas that have made up evolutionary theory, and this is like the newer form of that. And I wonder if there's even a modern synthesis where they've compiled even new information, including like epigenetics, which is this big thing that they're talking about nowadays. Of course, Mendel, who is the pea guy. I don't know if you remember the pea guy from science class in high school, where they had the purple peas and the blue peas. And if you have purple peas and blue peas, and if they swap and they're making little seed babies, you'll have like half and half, or whatever is more dominant, three quarters and a quarter, where out of four you'd have three purple, one blue. I hope that makes sense. I feel like everybody's been exposed to that. So he had this idea about how genes come from both parents that are putting into the new life form whenever things are genetically being swapped. You know, there's information coming from both sides that are being meshed into this new being. So Dobzhansky got the U.S. National Medal of Science in 1964, and he got the Franklin Medal in 1973, which was shortly before his death. So tonight, the work of his that I read, that I'll be discussing mainly, and with some of my own personal ideas and theories based off of his work, is The Biological Basis of Human Freedom, which, if you'll hold just briefly, I'll give you all of the copyright information. It's copyrighted in 1956 by Columbia University Press, New York. First printing in 1956, second printing in 1957. It's got a Library of Congress catalog card number 5611981. It's published all over the place. It doesn't have anything that says that I can't use it. Maybe it's because it's too old, which is cool. So I, as always, please don't bone me. That I'm not trying to sell any information. This is purely for educational purposes. And even though I will be taking some quotes out of this work tonight. Yeehaw, let's get into it. The nitty gritty. So, at the beginning of his work, he discusses, which I really liked, this is coming from a very science-minded person, but it speaks to my spiritual side heavily, looking at a lot of different types of texts. And I know this week I'm trying to stay away from the wooshy-gooshy and trying to stick more to the hard-knock current popular theories of philosophy for how we describe our existence, which a lot of people like to call science. But so he immediately begins speaking about how humankind, which is man, woman, child, and they, how humankind and nature, or at least humankind's development and how we've ended up where we are and all the factors that affected how we became humans is intrinsically a part of and like affected by and affects nature itself. Like we are intrinsically part of our environment, and we're never not part of our environment. We're never just separate little individuals. We're never separate from our societies, but even as a species, we are part of nature. Not to say that we're just some other piece of nature, which I would also say that any other piece of nature isn't just another piece of nature, because if it's all part of the environment, then every little bit is especially unique and has its own special life effect, which mainly throughout this work, Dobzhansky is trying to argue for the uniqueness and the special character of why humans are so amazing, which is always going to be the human bend and the seed of arrogance that I think is buried behind all of our knowledge seeking. But adaptation is to the environment, and the environment has the tendency to change. It doesn't stay stagnant often, and species that end up being destroyed, like, so humans have destroyed a lot of species, granted, but most species that have a hard time staying alive are the ones that have hyper specialized to their environment, and they only know how to do one thing, and so when their one thing isn't available anymore, they die off. One of the examples that would be the antithesis of that, which I thought was really cool, was he speaks about this type of bacteria. I think it's a streptomycin bacteria, which is a stomach bacteria. Or maybe that's a poison, but there's a bacteria that can't handle this poison. And a certain number of them, I think it's like, even like it's very small, it's like 3 in 1,000 of the bacteria will mutate to be able to handle the poison. But once they mutate to be able to handle the poison, they can't live in a normal environment. So they can only exist when the poison is there. So when the poison is in the environment, all the normal bacteria die off and only these weird mutants can survive. And when the opposite is in place, all the normies survive and the mutants die off, which is rather strange, but it's just this very short cycled example of how environment can drastically affect how iterations of creatures respond and how quickly any species can respond to the environment, which is this really strange, almost mystical process that I think they would label as natural selection, which, you know, is a crucial part of evolutionary theory. So there's, he kind of keeps hinting to this idea where there's the separation between biological evolution and change and cultural evolution and change. Where the biological evolution, which is what affects the hardware of what was the human element, set up the opportunity for us to be able to develop cultural forces such as language and such as, you know, theory and the ability to transmit things through things such as language. Which transmission is this idea of heredity, which we are always thinking about. At least often I think it, maybe not everybody's thinking about it, but somebody who might have ill health in their family might be worried that they might transmit, you know, bad disease or, you know. So there was this example in the book where I think it's Hutchinson's, where somebody can get past maturity where they can be able to pass their seed and have children, but in late years they have like horrible neurological deterioration. So without being able to look at it for genetic markers and being able to track it, you could have a bunch of kids that are doomed to like this horrible outcome. But heredity isn't always about just being the fittest creature. For instance, there's always this idea of like, you know, the gym scenario where big macho dude on the block or whatever is the one who is the most admirable, or the female that is the most admirable will get the most suitors versus whatever. But that's not always the case, where even if something's not the best hunter or the best gatherer or the best whatever, there could be weaker links that are able to come to some sort of sexual fruition and pass along their seed. And so when it comes to the grand scheme of things and evolution, it's not always about being the strongest creature, because there's always going to be not the fittest that are able to propagate. And it's kind of sort of what is looking like what's happening nowadays almost in our current climate. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Idiocracy, but it's like when you have a climate and an environment that doesn't reward or encourage intelligence, a bigger population seems to encourage the ones that can have the most kids, and usually more intelligent, quote unquote, whatever that means, families, more educated families don't have as many kids as quote unquote uneducated families. So it's like, you know, the higher the population gets, as, and this is basically the movie theme of the movie Idiocracy, is where this guy gets thrown into the future and there's like 14 billion people on the planet, and everybody wears like logo shirts of like all these fast food chains, and they just watch like 10 TV screens, and everybody's like basically just an idiot because we've devolved into this situation. And it's a joke on this idea of sometimes the fittest aren't rewarded. It's the ones that can get laid or whatever and are able to propagate. You know, and I kind of saw this in this documentary last night that I was watching. It was really good. There's this new show called Animals on Netflix. And they have a really good cephalopod episode that focuses on octopuses and cuttlefish, which octopuses are probably like my favorite creature of all time, hands down. And cuttlefish are pretty cool, just watching them. But within cuttlefish groups, they kind of like migrate and meet up in these huge collection of cuttlefish for their mating rituals. And the big ass cuttlefish are the ones that usually dominate and try to lock down female cuttlefish. But like the little ones will like hide and act like they're female cuttlefish to get closer, and then they'll still be able to propagate. And so it's like, I think that it's like on average, like 30-40% of new cuttlefish come from this strategy where the smaller, weaker cuttlefish are able to outwit and able to propagate, through a different strategy that isn't about size or strength, which is really interesting and weird. But anyways, let's see what Dobzhansky has to say about heredity. I had a couple things highlighted. I don't know how relative they are, but I just want you to get a hint of like how this man thinks and what his speech flow and his ideas seem to come across as. So this is page 12 out of the chapter Man's Kinship with Nature. This was, however, a delusion, for sex cells actually have nothing resembling the parts of the body of an adult organism. What sex cells do transmit is a dynamic physiological pattern, a pattern of metabolism which makes them develop through a succession of definite stages into a fertilized egg, a fetus, an infant, a child, a youth, an adult, an old man or an old woman, and sooner or later a dead body. The sex cells are then merely the vehicle or the containers for the developmental motion that will be set in action. So it's like, I think right before this, he mentions how there was this theory in medieval ideology. Maybe there was just spaces of where our thought processes shifted in and out, but where they thought that like the whatever the little fetus was like a miniature human and it just got bigger, you know, whereas that's not the case. Like cells develop over time in stages, you know, and then after a baby is born, there's still more developmentary changes and stages. Like a baby brain is vastly different than an adult human brain. But I digress. So further down the page, abilities and disabilities are not inherited as separate entities. They are merely aspects of the developmental pattern of the organisms. So the ability and what, like, so the difference between a phenotype and a genotype. A genotype is the genetic expression and like the cards that we have, like the cards, the hand that we hold, whereas the phenotype is what we show. So we can have the genetic expression for things and they might be recessive and hidden and they might not be showing. And what we do show is our phenotype. So the abilities and the disabilities are part of this phenotypic display. And the genes that humans carry and that we've developed throughout our biological beginnings and origins are what set up the cards that we have, but what shows is the ability and the disabilities. And so there's a slight separation between what is seen from behavior and what is biological. And yeah. Shortly after, on page 16, he continues to discuss, and here goes, biological shorthand expressions, such as the gene for eye color, should then not be taken too literally. There is no gene which could by itself manufacture an eye, or an eye color, or a taste reaction, or criminal or law-abiding behavior. We do not inherit pigments, or tastes, or behaviors. What we do inherit is a constellation of genes, a genotype. So this is, again, what I was kind of just discussing. I guess I was kind of leading into. Where even something like the color of an eye has several hands of cards that are working in concert to make an expression. So there's a constellation. I really like that word. A constellation of genes that make this genotype that have happened to make a species that is capable of what we are capable of. But I would also say for anything, in any life form, it's kind of amazing how anything has been able to learn how to fit an ish and show its own form of intelligence in its own beautiful way. And that goes for every single individual out there as well, and every single person in our human societies that is existing and doing and happening right now. Yeah. So in the next chapter, he goes into talking about culture and how culture is this thing that has developed out of our humanness, which I don't know. I know I've talked about orcas. I think there's other things that are culture. And he speaks about insects and insect societies that I find highly intriguing. And I would say there's all kinds of different social animals, but I guess he has this separation between what's social and what is cultural, which I don't know. I think it's just this humanness trying to make the human special. Again, I don't see a big difference if it's adapted. You know, I guess it's just a matter of scale, and because we've done huge technological things and fucked over so many other life forms. But I digress. So culture has an evolving process, and culture seems to change over time and to transmit. And the way that biology compounds on itself and how biological life forms are able to evolve and split into species because of different speciation, culture has this ability to speciate as well. And so through the cultural transmission process, there's like all these different like breeds of ideas. And of course, there's races of people as well. There's biological differences of people where we have different abilities. You know, people from closer equatorial lines have more skin pigment and the ability to not roast, whereas in a place that gets less sunlight, it's more of a benefit to have less skin pigment, and is able to get more vitamin D from the sunlight that is received, whereas it's completely opposite when that role is reversed. And sometimes when in different environments, which is very common now, where we have a very mixed plural society, it's a beautiful melting pot in most places of the world because of the ease of locomotion, the ability to move and migrate, which has always been a human element, this migratory drive to go see what's over the horizon. You know, it's very common for people in different environments to have medical issues. Like myself, I'm very pale. Doesn't matter where I am, I roast and I'm probably going to have a lot of skin cancer. I'm already having pieces of skin burned off of me, and I'm not even really close to the equator. I'm just high in elevation, you know, living in the mountains. Like, so it's very interesting to think about how the environment affects the biological evolution, and the environment with our intrinsic place in it must affect the cultural evolution of all the different societies that exist on this planet. Well, let's see what he has to say about it. I'm gonna try to find a good one. So off of page 28, human evolution is a singular product of interaction between biology and culture. That's what I was leading into. On the next page. This is because every human being is born into a group whose customs and beliefs are established before he arrives on the scene. Through the learning process, he or she acquires these customs and beliefs, and he learns his cultural lessons so well that much of his behaviors in later years take the form of automatic responses to the cultural stimuli with which he is presented. Which is talking about the socialization of our species. Language is the most important product of culture, and at the same time is its vehicle, facilitating the perpetuation and further development of culture. Most animals are able to produce and to perceive sounds, and the different kinds of sounds which an animal can produce are frequently put to use in establishing communication between individuals of its species. The songs of crickets, katydids, and cicadas play a role in helping the two sexes find each other. In birds and in mammals, sounds may express emotions and may be used to warn strangers away from territories already occupied by representatives of the same species, to attract one's kind to sources of food, or to give an alarm when danger is approaching. I think he's very fluent in his ability to put across a lot of these ideas. And of course, language is profound when it comes to its action as a vehicle in transmitting things. And language is not a strictly human thing. Like, even he admits, the use of vocal sounds and even symbolic language is a facet of life. But the human ability to transmit from generation to generation seems to be very special. And even though I think they're like the orcas and their pods and how they hunt the sharks, look into it. I do think that from generation to generation, things are passed along, but I can read things from people who wrote something down 5,000 years ago. And I'm not sure that those sort of memories are written down so archaically, where orcas or whales or parrots or crows or ants or bumblebees are realistically reading what bees 5,000 years ago were saying, or what have you. So I get that, where which it is kind of compelling to think about how we've used our language. And maybe it's not even just language, but it's writing in general. I don't remember what page, but he, Dobzhansky, in his book here, says that writing came out around 5,000 years ago, which is about 3,000 BC. So to say, maybe there was other forms of writing that were just lost to existence, maybe. But within that time period, amazing things have happened. And within the past even 500 years, huge movements have happened. It's very insane. Really. And I try not to make our species out to be so special. I always try to argue that we're not so special. But yeah, some pretty intense things have happened with our brains. And the Odysseus here makes a fantastic argument for that side. Culture propagates mainly through writing, through storytelling. And before writing, there was the storytelling, which I think animals do. We propagate culture through action. When we see, monkey do. Like even other primates show intense cultural transmission of just fads, where I heard the story about where one chimp started carrying a rock around, and within like 5 years, like tribes, like multiple tribes in this area were like, all the younger chimps were carrying around like a pet rock. And like, why? Because they just saw another one do it. And so that's going to be the primary way that we transmit any sort of strategy for anything, really, is going to be seeing somebody else do it through an apprenticeship. But he makes a compelling argument for insects doing the opposite, where a lot of the times you can have a pupa being born and immediately goes into a task. I guess there's certain breeds of ants, or I think it was bees. Yeah, there's really cool things about bees, where the bees themselves, when they're first born, within the first couple of days, their only job is to feed the other bees that are being born. So they're like feeding themselves. And then like from day 6 to day 9, they get up and they feed other bees. I think that's like the step up above them. And then from day 7 to 10, they start to do like house duty. So they start to like sort the food that the worker bees that are gathering from outside, they'll receive and sort the food. And then from days 12 to 15, they'll go out and start to do the worker bees. You know, so they have these stages, that these strict stages that they go through. And they don't seem to watch anybody do it. They naturally glide from one stage to the next in their developmentary process, which seems like it's an innate behavior. Whereas a lot of these human attributes seem to be learned and exist in this cultural realm that has a separateness from the biological evolution, which he was trying to argue these innate abilities and these innate actions, these instinctual actions, are part of our biology and are like ingrained in us, which, I mean, you see with cats and litter box training of any animal. It's natural now because of so many generations of breeding into their domestication. And you see it with dogs. Certain dogs are just ready to be retrievers and ready to be dredge dogs, where they like, I don't know, some dogs will like pull boats, like Newfoundlands will literally be like sled dogs but for water, so they'll pull boats behind them, they're so powerful. But these innate abilities seem to be almost ingrained biologically into the genotype, and then they just express without having to be learned. I know that humans have a lot of these weird actions where like little babies, if you tickle their heels, they'll kick and they'll start to walk. And it's a really good way to start to stimulate the walking action, is to tickle the heels and let them feel it on the ground. And it seems to be, that seems to be, at least to me, it appeared to be, to help, you know, it's like it's there, it's an instinctual action there to help the parent get the kid walking, with how dumb our children are, because, you know, our babies are very weak when they're born in comparison to like an insect pupa, which is born and can go to work like right away, right then, right there.
Yeah, very strange. And like, don't try it. I never did, but I read that like babies underneath like the age of 3 or 6 months or something like that, if they're underwater, they'll hold their breath. Like they don't have to be taught to, which is a very incredible life preserving phenomena for when, I guess, a parent fucks up. I guess that's happened enough times in biological history that we've evolved to not do that, I guess. Yeah. And from there, he goes into a lot of really awesome theories against, you know, like racism, where, you know, this social Darwinism and this survival of the fittest idea often gets people to argue for, you know, certain unlike traits. Like, you know, you have these traits that you want, like intelligence, strength, attractiveness, symmetry, whatever. And there's always gonna be traits like, you know, criminal activity, deviancy that you don't want, you know, difficult behavior that you don't want. And wouldn't it be amazing if you could have a genetic marker for that? And I guess Dobzhansky's argument is that all these outward expressions and phenotypes might be based upon genetic hardware, but there's no real strict hereditary or genetic marker for deviancy or even intelligence or goodness or badness. You know, somebody could be physically large and an idiot. Somebody could be really small and a brave heart, you know? And so he's basically saying the idea that you could say racially any race was bad or good was a stupid, stupid thing to do. And I loved it, especially coming from the time period, which wasn't really go lucky. And I guess I don't know a lot of, I'm not even gonna make any sort of comments about that region of the globe. I have no idea about their racial inclusion, but yeah. So on page 55, here he goes again. Language facilitated the accumulation and transmission of a body of learned behavior and traditions known as culture. The influence of culture on the evolutionary pattern of mankind occurred then by way of biological causation. So the reason we have culture and the ability to do it happened because we evolved to get there. The things that are language that every like, so there's this really interesting list that I'll get to, but there's like these benchmarks that every single species seems to have, sort of like we all seem to develop along a very similar path. I hope my pages aren't annoying. I'll have to hear it later. Yeah. Survival of the fittest is really survival of the sexiest, I guess. Really, when it comes down to it, and the ability could be based on intelligence and strategy sometimes. Not that I care. So, diversity of environment leads to variation, and variation can be kind of like counterculture. Like the hippie movement was a variation, but a lot of people, like I'm pretty sure I heard it sung somewhere once, that the cops caused the hippie movement as much as the hippie movement caused the radicalization of cops. The Blue Lives Matter movement is just as much based on the Black Lives Matter movement as the political pulls and motivations of the Black Lives Matter movement, BLM, is based upon the Blue Lives Matter movement. It's all intrinsically combined, just like nature and the individual, or the society and the one, the unit. Another thing that I really liked about what he had to say was this idea that a lot of people have always tried to push that competition are the major checks, like Mathis, and how competition is what leads things to get stronger or to develop better or worse is because they have to compete with each other. Where a lot of other anti-theories against this have tried to argue that cooperation might be more motivating in some cases, which is what has often happened with things like bonobos, which I've talked about on other episodes. I can't quote it right now, but you can go into my backlog at any time. I have a lot of great material other than this episode. It's non-sequential, so you can listen to all of them independently at any time. Unfortunately, most of my stuff, or fortunately in my case, most of my stuff is long form, but you can split it up. You can chunk it out and listen to it at different times. So don't be scared. So cooperation, I've always had this theory, like if me and you are out and we are depending upon one another and we are existing for one another and we're in some sort of multifamily society, I'm not trying to compete with you. I want you to be stronger so that we can be a stronger composite, and that if we can get by with not having warfare, and I think warfare and its grandiosity that we see within humanity and its modern format now is very inhumane. And I don't think it was as common in our biological past and how we existed for most of human history. But that is, of course, a personal theory, and I cannot support it entirely with empirical scientific evidence like Dobzhansky lays it out. And I'm probably butchering my summary of his book here. I'm really pulling out ideas that I thought were really interesting. And I encourage you to look into evolutionary biology and genetics and epigenetics and all these really cool fringe sciences that we're getting into, because this stuff's old that he was talking about. And I find it fascinating because I'm dumb and I'm not really well versed on it. But I'm sure there's a lot of people that would have very interesting things to talk about from what's happening now, right now in 2021, going into 2022 here soon. Probably very scary things like with CRISPR and genetic manipulation, and everybody's fear of GMOs. Maybe I'll have an episode on that sometime. But yeah, I always do this right in the middle of the episode, but please look down into the show notes. There is a link where you can click an email address and you can have a correspondence with me, and we can talk and discuss anything from the show. And if you want to educate me or you have any other ideas on what you would like to hear or an addition to this, I will present it shortly, to and we can add on to this. We can build and we can have some sort of community based around the this curiosity that I like to call life and nature, whatever. But let's get to the end here. So I found that list of things. This, he calls them the common denominators, which, if you remember that from math, not to speak down to you, but the common denominator is the thing that when you boil it down to the end, like, it's the factor between everything. So between most societies, and this is going to be a really long one, so I apologize, but I think its length is compelling in its own right to show you how many things we do share as humans between big and small, large societies and rural to urban and tribal to non. There seems to be methods of age grading, athletic sports, bodily adornment, just like, you know, like jewelry, calendaring, ways to tell time-ish. I know that there is certain societies that don't have any methods of telling time, and they don't even have time words. They don't have any ability to discuss like what is before or after. So when they're planning, they like in their language, they just say, I'll see you when I see you. Like they have no way to say like when I'll see you tomorrow. Like, hey, I'll meet you at 8 o'clock here and there. They don't have any time words. So they're like, I'll see you when I see you. And then they'll just run into each other and then they'll do what they need to do when they see each other, which is kind of crazy. But cleanliness training, which is, you know, like sort of toiletry, ways that we teach our children to take care of themselves and to keep themselves clean. And the way that we clean ourselves based upon that, which is all socializing in society. Community organization, to an extent, you know, that would be depending upon the different society and how it's organized. Like the millions of people or the billions of people in some societies now are going to be differently organized, and you see it in the different types of political stratification. Cooperative labor, cooking, cosmology, you know, how we explain our existence in the world, even atheism and denial of cosmology is a cosmology in its own right. Courtship, dancing, decorative art, divination, division of labor, dream interpretation, education, eschatology, I don't know what that is, ethics, ethnobotany, etiquette, faith healing, family, feasting, fire making, folklore, food taboos, funeral rites, games, gestures, gift giving, government, greetings, hairstyles, hospitality, housing, hygiene, incest, taboos, inheritance. Sorry, I know I told you guys this is a long one. Rules, joking, kin groups, kinship nomenclature, language, law, luck, superstitions, magic, marriage, mealtimes, medicine, modesty, concerning natural functions, mourning, music, mythology, numerals, obstetrics, penal sanctions. Penal, not, I think that's like prison. Personal names, population policy, postnatal care, pregnancy usages, property rights, appropriation of supernatural beings, puberty customs, religious rituals, residence roles, sexual restrictions, soul concepts, soul, like the duality ideas, the separation between mind and body, and observation of both mind and body, status differentiation, surgery, tool making, trade, visiting, weaning, and weather control. So that's a very long list of similarities shared between all the things that we think are so different between different societies. And look at all the things that we share. Like, it's such a beautiful thing, I think. So the bugs are really cool. Let's see what I can remember because I'm not going to be able to quote it. So there's a lot of really interesting type of ants. There's species of ants that make slaves. There's even species of ants that can't survive on their own, so they depend upon slave labor. So they'll literally like they'll steal the babies of other species of ants, and then the other ants will just like be like, "All right, I'm working for you guys now." And I don't know if it's based upon pheromones or something like that. There's cultural termites in the way that they do their architecture. So different species of termites and different species of ants will build their nests in specific ways in different geologic or geographic locations. So it's like almost like a cultural thing on how they build their homes. There's ants that propagate fungus. I know I have always seen them on the documentaries where they'll go and they're like leaf cutter ants, and they'll go collect portions of certain types of leaves, and then they'll inoculate them with mycelium, and then they'll garden the fungus, and then that's what they eat. And so when they go and make new colonies, the colonizing ants will take chunks of the mycelium, and that's how they'll start to grow. So they have like you know how baker's yeast is like specific strains, like they have garden specific strains that they use and they take to form new living spaces and new societies, which is fucking culture if you don't tell me. there's crazy specializations, sorry, I just butcher words sometimes, specialization, such as like queens, where they're literally like, you know, the queens of certain bee colonies and certain ant colonies will be huge swollen masses, and like they'll be the only fertile female in the whole entire colony, whereas every other ant might be infertile workers, and that's just what they do, is they just make sure that the mama queen just keeps pumping out new insects. He even mentions there's certain species that only have to like be inculcated once, and then they don't have to ever actually perform the act again, and they can have up to like 70,000 babies a day, and that's all they do, which is almost foul to me. And then like bee language, so bees, when they go find things, they can go back to the colony and they perform these elaborate dances where they can communicate over vast distances specifically how to find what they're talking about. And it is a symbolic language, which we can't hear what they're buzzing with it, but it screams of speech, and it's very weird to think about. Look up this video on Google or YouTube or wherever you find your videos, and look up wingless bee, and see if you can find the video. It's like this person who had this wingless bee, and like he learned how to feed it like sugar water through like a sponge and shit, and it survived for a long time, and he'd put on flowers and shit to go see it's like its other flightful brethren. But yeah, we're not the only ones who talk. Like, there's no way. There's all different types of forms of languages and every single other bit of life that exists out there. It's definitely worth a gander to look into it a little bit more. Anyways, I have rambled along enough for this week. I'm going to pass it along to my favorite segment, and me and my son will show you out.
Okay, hello, people. It's Axco with Brandon J. So, let's make. So, Brandon J, what's our question today?
How do you learn from other people? And do people learn things from you? When people see you act a certain way, do people act like that?
No, then don't.
People don't pick up what you do?
No, because people might think you're wrong.
Sometimes, but say when you see me do something like drink out of a cup, you probably figured out how to drink out of cups from watching people do it, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you kind of see somebody do something, and then that's how we learn, right?
Yep.
So do you think other people learn from you too?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about where we are? Like, if you're at school, do you learn differently at school than when you're at home?
Yes.
So tell me more about that.
So, it's like somebody doing homework, and already know it's the homework, and then boy, copy your homework, them could be wrong.
Oh, so when somebody copies your work and they don't know what they're doing, they're just copying it down? Think that could be wrong?
Yeah, it might be wrong.
So is it better to think for ourselves sometimes too?
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. So today what we're discussing, this whole idea, it's culture. And our culture is how we do things and why we do things. And in our culture, we wear pants and we wear shirts and we wear shoes, right?
Uh-huh.
Do we say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir?
Yes.
Yep. So these are all kinds of manners, and these are part of our culture. That makes sense, bud?
Yep.
Anyways, to wrap it up, I know you've been having a rough time at school. What are some strategies that you can think of on how to have an easier time and have less hard times at school?
Well, I'm getting a break and And having a reading break, when the reading break's done, maybe you could feel better.
Oh, yeah? So taking a break from difficulty can make you feel better sometimes?
Yep. And I have another thing to say. When you can tell the teacher, I don't understand this work, please help me, then the teacher will help you.
That's a great idea. You want to say bye-bye to everybody?
Bye, everybody. This is Asko, by the way, and so bye, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in and getting all the way to the end of the show. The Gingerbread Man and my son, we're very, very grateful for your ears and for your time and for your energy, and I hope that you have an absolutely wonderful week, and I can't wait to speak to you next week. Have a great time. Bye.